Star jump sequence terminates, Captain.
Get the gravitational dampers online and open the blast shield.
Aye, sir.
Bring us in closer.
Aye, aye, sir. Moving us in on sublight drive.
Extreme magnification.
Aye, sir.
The center of the galaxy. And there's our black hole.
The experience of a lifetime, Captain.
Let me put this on audio. You should be able to hear the magnetic resonance.
This is it, ladies and gentlemen. The edge of time and space, where the impossible can happen. Welcome to the event horizon.
Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whatever is relevant for the part of the world you are in. Indeed, welcome to the event horizon, where the impossible happens. Join us each week at this time as we delve into the worlds of science fiction, fantasy, and science fact in all their forms. I am your host, Gene Turnbow.
And I am your other host, Susan Fox.
And with us is one of the most prolific composers in the Hollywood soundtrack workspace, Mr. Simon Franklin. Welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you with us.
Gene and Susan, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
We have just watched Avatar, The Way of Water. And that is one long show. That was 312 minutes.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I didn't look at my watch once.
And it's...
You know, it is action wall-to-wall. And there is music wall-to-wall, and that's what we want to talk about, of course.
So did you watch Way of Water, or did you watch Fire and Ash?
Well, we can't watch Fire and Ash at home yet, so...
All right, got it. Yes, so Way of Water.
And
it.
If we did, we wouldn't admit to it, but we didn't.
Yes, fair enough.
So you stepped into Fire... you stepped into The Way of Water some part way through because James Horner passed.
Did you have any contact with him directly?
Well, I did Avatar 1. I was the lead arranger on Avatar 1.
You were? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that was the... And James died in middle of 2015.
Yeah.
So Avatar 2 hadn't even been started filming yet.
I see. Okay.
So I came into it at the end of 2017 is when we started. And we started shooting Avatar 2 and Avatar 3 together in 2017 and 18 and 19. And then I started scoring Avatar 2 in 2021 and 2022, all the way through to the end of 2022 when we released it. Then I had a few months off, and then I've spent the last 2.5 years working on Avatar 3. So it's been fairly intense, and it's been there's been a lot of music.
That's an amazingly large project. It's
each of them is like two films.
Yeah, yeah. I so on Avatar, on the one you've just watched, The Way of Water, I wrote 2 hours and 50 minutes of music.
Oh.
And for Avatar 3, Fire and Ash, I wrote 3 hours and 4 minutes of music.
So
in the film.
The next film is wall-to-wall music. There is almost no time at which...
I think I have 10 minutes off for good behavior.
Somebody or singing. I mean, there's... did you write the songs as well?
Yes, I did. I co-wrote all the songs. Okay. And then all the
vocals. There's a lot of... La Navi.
Yeah, so they're all of the... Generally, if there are Navi lyrics in the films, they are real lyrics. They're not just gibberish. I like the idea that if we have something that seems appropriate to where we are, then we should be singing lyrics that are appropriate to where we are.
I love the fact that they went to the detail of creating the entire Navi language so that they could be done.
That's where I work with Paul Frommer, who's the man who created the language. And so he and I would send him my lyrics, and then he would critique them and improve them.
The amount of planning that it takes to do a project this size must be substantial. And you must have a team of people working with you.
Compared to the vast majority of composers, I have an incredibly tiny team. So it is not uncommon for me to go and see other people, composers working, and them to have 20 people in the control room. I have five.
Oh my
Oh my
gosh.
word.
So six if you include the recording engineer, but that's it. I have a very, very small team. I'm very hands-on with the music in terms of that regard. And so it's I'm somewhat different to the other to many other composers, is that I work in a very small team, that we work very efficiently. We know each other very well. I have two music editors, I have two arrangers who also orchestrate for me, and I have one assistant, and that's it.
That is remarkable. The amount of organization that that takes is just to keep all of that in your head. I mean, one of the advantages, I suppose, of having a smaller team like that is that you must be doing some of the other roles that would ordinarily be handled by other physical people yourself. So the inter-team communication is happening from one side of your skull to the other in a lot
I
of
think
ways.
that's fair, because remember, but before I became a composer, I was a session musician and an arranger. So that I used to do that for people like James Horner, or for Alan Silvestri, or for whoever, and or Howard Shore. And so I had done those jobs for other composers. And that skill set of using synthesizers, for instance, my big thing was the use of electronics in music, in film music, and in pop records. The HAL programming, as we used to call it. And so all of that side is still my bag, really. So the drums and the grooves and the rhythms and the synths are that's I tend to do almost all of that. So there aren't other people doing that for me. We've tried other people, and there's some really phenomenal people, but it's such an essential part of who I am that it always ends up being easier for me to do it myself.
Because sometimes the effort involved in translating your thoughts into something you can communicate verbally is perhaps more work than just going forth and doing it yourself.
Yeah, it's the I have a particular skill set, to paraphrase, and that would be that if that would be my superpower in terms of the way that I use those sorts of things. I think Hans might tell you also that the way he uses synthesizers is something that's ingrained in him, and I think there are. Some of us who came from that world, talking to Tom Holkenborg, I think he and I've chatted about this, and that it's a thing that you have a particular style in the way that you use things. And so, my style, I prefer to you do the programming myself.
You are no stranger to synthesizers and synthetic instrumentation. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how you got started with that and how it influenced?
Well, that was my day job. So when I first started, I moved into recording. I sort of knew what I wanted to do very early on. And I went into London recording studios earlier working. I was working for a guy called Trevor Horn, who was a record producer, using a thing called the Synclavier, which was one of the big early music computers.
Yes.
And so I was then persuaded from producing, I was doing records and commercials and TV shows in England, I was persuaded to come out to America. And I came out to America, and I found a niche as a synth programmer in Los Angeles, as a session musician. And I would make whole records. People would hire me to do entire projects. So rather than just, say, playing 3 hours on a song, they would hire me to do the whole thing, or they would hire me to do the whole film. And so I had a, I was using a lot of electronics. I was building a lot of sounds. Soundscapes was very much part of what I was doing in terms of the things that people wanted me to do. And so I had racks and racks of synthesizers when I was doing films in the 90s and so on. I was carrying around 2 tons of synths with me, and that was the normal rig.
Excuse me, I am fangirling a lot right now.
Well, I mean, it's I th if there's a synth, almost certainly I have used it at some point. I got rid of lots of them and wished I hadn't got rid of lots of them, but I have a few still dotted around that I keep. I move mostly to virtual these days, just because I have to, because the changes, the speed with which I have to make changes, the walls and modulars and things like that that we used to have, it's difficult to get the reproducibility that I need for my job.
Well, not to mention the physical size of it all. You can't drag a trailer truck around with you.
Yeah, this
Well, I
isn't
mean,
all on
it's fair to say that the piano isn't exactly a small thing that I can chuck in the backpack. But
it.
you can usually find a piano somewhere. Whereas an ARP 2600 or a Matrix 12 is slightly more difficult to get.
Now that shows how far back you go, the ARP 2600.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And,
Like 1990, no, 1980. I want to say two.
it could be. I mean, I've got mine were later than that, but I had an orange mini. I can't remember what they're called, but as well as the blue. But I had two or three Mini Moogs, and I have none of them left. I got rid of, for some reason, I got rid of my Mini Moogs. I have Jupiter 8, I've still got, which is the original. I had racks and racks of everything. I had four. There was a point when it was a thing when we were working live with orchestra, you could only make one sound with one synthesizer. And imagine you had a situation where I was working with Alan Silvestri, and he might want four different sounds from a Korg M1 in a particular piece of music, in a particular cue when we're doing it live with orchestra. So that means you need to have four Korg M1s
Because
or
there's no
M1Rs.
such thing as a programmable preset in those
No,
days.
you had to switch and be able to have them all playing exactly as you wanted to, or there was all of these things. I have some Oberheims. My brother, who still owns his CS80, he still has an original CS80, and he has a Oberheim 8 voice that the and so on. So we have kept it in the family, and I have I definitely have. At some point, failed abysmally with something with every synthesizer out there.
Because they all have their weak spots, and you don't find them until you get in trouble.
Oh, it was that very much so. And so you'd sit there and try these different things and think, "Oh, this is going to be the one that changes my world," and invariably there will be something. Nah, that's not quite right. And there will be the ones you end up that do survive. So, I've got like a Prophet VS downstairs. That around, which is it's really interesting. It does one or two things great, but but it was temperamental.
Great for solo voices, not so great for polyphony.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing. When we were building, a lot of the time I'm building synths, and these days I build custom patches left, right, and center, and I'm blending lots of stuff. But I found, as somebody who has owned everything and knew and remembered how much these sound, what the sounds are like, I found I can make pretty well everything I want now with some of the virtual synths that are out there now, are so astonishingly good with some of the plugins that the create that I can make things that I couldn't dream of before.
So, the software you use, Ableton,
I write in Pro Tools. I'm one of the few people who
Pro
does that.
Tools. Ah, okay. I think one of
Yeah.
our other composer friends, David Raiklin, who is he writes theatrical scores as well. I think he uses Pro Tools.
There's a few of us out there. I was a Logic guy. Well, the Synclavier first, then Logic, and there was a point when I moved to using Pro Tools. I did try Cubase at the beginning of a couple of years ago. Because I was unhappy with where Pro Tools was going with MIDI, and it was great for the first few months. I was loving it, and then there were some very basic things I wanted to do in there. I couldn't quite get it to do what I wanted. I know I've got lots of friends who are extremely happy with Cubase, but for me, there was a couple of problems in the way that it worked, and more fundamentally, everything else in film world is Pro Tools from the beginning to the end. So, by staying in Pro Tools, it meant that I could actually, I never convert. Everybody else has like Cubase, or they have Logic, or they have Ableton, or they have Fruity Loops, or they.
But Pro Tools is the one common touchstone
It
that
exactly. So
everybody uses.
they always end up converting to Pro Tools. I don't bother with that.
Huh.
So I've got my entire team. We work with a very sophisticated template that's taken me a while with them to build. We do everything in Dolby Atmos surround from the very first note that I write. I'm writing in surround, and I've got I'm basically making a my template has 47.1.2 stems in it as standard.
Wow.
Yeah, and it
Wow.
all works perfectly. And what used to be 2 tons of equipment has now become 2 Mac Studios. I can carry my entire studio in my backpack now.
That is amazing. That is amazing. It certainly helps on the power bills.
Tell me about it. I have in the studio here when the Synclavier, I have a sync, I still own the Synclavier, it's in storage, but and I bring it out every so often. But I have a special 40 amp line just for switching it on when it was here.
Oh my God.
The whole street, you could feel the street
Oh,
dim gently as I would switch it on, and all the fans would go, and there would be 18 fans along the back of the rack. And the rack weighed 600 pounds, and literally switching on, there was a pulse at 40 amps. So
my
we were,
God.
anyway. So, yeah,
Wow.
life has got a lot simpler.
So, with respect to how this influenced your writing style, I mean, previously composers would come up through conventional instruments. Obviously, piano is one of yours. I think Hans Zimmer said was he started out as a percussionist.
Well, yeah, and Hans, I remember Hans was in London. He had a studio called Lily Yard. He used to do jingles. He was the guy also who fixed, James Horner told me that he fixed, Hans repaired the fairlight they were using on a film called Name of the Rose in Germany. They were doing the film Name of the Rose. Ian Underwood, who was the great legendary synthesizer, one of the original mothers of invention, was working with James Horner. Their fairlight broke down, and the kid who came down to help them fix it was this kid called Hans Zimmer.
Wow.
So he worked in Germany doing that, and then he came to London and started working doing jingles. Then he was hired to play synthesizers and keyboards for other composers and so on. And I think I come in, there's a long history of session musicians becoming composers. I'm not trying to compare myself to them, but for instance, there was this piano player called Johnny Williams, who would play for Henry Mancini. He was Henry Mancini's pianist, and he was also Alfred Newman's pianist, and so on. And he was part of the house band in over at Fox. And James Newton Howard was a session player. And toured and so on. So all of us, I not all of us, but there has been a history of this. And I think the one great thing about my life as being a session player initially was I understudied under great composers. I had five or six people I would consider my mentors in terms of, and I would work with them for long periods of time, but I was also doing hundreds of records. And you learn to adapt. And if there's a one skill that you need as a film composer, it's to be able to adapt to what's going on, because every film is different and you need to write a piece of music that fits that film. So the score I write for Avatar, try putting that on Star Wars and it wouldn't fit.
Well,
And so on. And you so films should have scores that are written specifically for them, I think. That is a thing that I think coming through the session world, I learned to adapt, and I also learned to be quite fast with my electronics, with my synthesizers. Because when you're working for somebody else, you learn to be really good at what you're using in a way that if you are the only person doing it, you sometimes fall into habits because you haven't had somebody else pushing you. And I think that the fact that I had a particular pop artist shouting at me because something wasn't quick enough made me quicker on one thing, or and so on. Or if we were in a film, there's a 100-piece orchestra there waiting for me to sort something out. You get quick and you get very good at adapting to what's going on. And I think that was part of my education. But the synthesizers have always been my skill is I don't think when I use them. I don't think when I use computers at all. At no point is it feel it's they're like an extension of myself. I play studio rather than piano. I very much there are infinitely better pianists than me who are out there who are pure pianists. I, on the other hand, give me a studio, I can make it sing. And that I think is my skill is you can give me any synthesizer, you can give me any DAW, you can give me anything, and I will be perfectly comfortable using it. It doesn't feel difficult, it feels completely natural to me.
And you can see that in your resume because the films are very different from each other.
Yeah,
There's a
because
couple of
that's
James Bond movies. That's
I
not
was
my
an arranger
avatar.
on Spectre and Skyfall. Yes, I had enormous fun doing working for Tom Newman on those. Yeah. People would hire me because I was hopefully good at what I did, but also I had if you if it, I have a groove and people liked my groove, whether it was on records but in film. I've always felt, for instance, that if you can get people's if you can get head bob, that's a way that you can get that tends to, if you can do that with people, even in the cinema, it helps. And so my rhythmic approach has been an essential part of how I work.
About 60 to 70% of the information about a story and how the action is going in a film seems to come from the soundtrack. Would you agree?
I think it's massively undervalued by many people. Jim Cameron would say to you that it's 50%, that he thinks it's 50% visuals, 50% sound. He thinks it's incredibly important. He takes sound, he takes music ridiculously seriously.
Well, he's a composer too, though. I mean, he's a songwriter.
Well, but not on the same, doesn't function on the same level as.
Oh, but he has
Jim,
an appreciation for music.
sorry, I'm talking about Jim Cameron, James Cameron, the film director. Yeah, I wouldn't think he would say he was a songwriter, but he would say that.
I thought he'd written some songs, but
Oh yeah, but
what now?
he would say he had no musical ability at all, and I would disagree with him drastically, that he absolutely has he has ability, but he understands the power of sound, and how you can use sound to manipulate people, and but. I think there's an emotional thing that music does in a film. It does the underscore is really important, and I think especially in science fiction and fantasy films, scores are important because we're building worlds. We're trying to tell you that you're on a planet you've never visited before, that that you've never been that in a world that you've never inhabited, and part of the sound that, for instance, I hopefully create for the Avatar film, for Avatar 2 and 3. And for what we did in Avatar 1 was to create a sense of place. And I'd say the same thing applies if you're in a bar in Tatooine, if you're, it doesn't matter where you are, there's a sense of place that is essential to the weather because we, in the science fiction and fantasy areas, it's world building a lot of the time. Whereas you take stuff like this, should we say the sort of Mission Impossible, you're on Earth, you know what's going on. And I'm not trying to, but in any way denigrate because they're amazing. But I just mean that you're saying to somebody, maybe I'm in Marrakesh or I'm in Rome or I'm in London or I'm thinking, but that's the extent of the world that you're trying to create musically. Then you're just trying to support the story with. The films that we work on, like, say something like this, or any of the, should we say, Marvel films or anything, any of the fantasy genres, you're attempting to build a sonic world, and the sound effects are important, but the music is, I think, just as.
And it plays so much of a role in telling the story itself. I mean, it's one thing to be presented with a scene that's a wonderful triumph or a personal tragedy, and you have to decide for yourself how you feel about it. But if you have the music telling you what this is supposed to mean, you're way ahead of the game as an audience.
It's also that I have to do things sometimes where I'm going to tell you that I've got to tell you that what you think is happening isn't happening. You know, you can have a hello, Mary, hello, Tom conversation. Would you like a cup of tea? Those sort of things that go on. And I can, with a single note, make that feel as if there's something wrong. You
Something
know?
in the tea that you shouldn't be
Yeah,
sipping.
exactly. And those are the things where I'm playing. Film music is slightly different to television music. I think television music tells you what you've got to think immediately. It's on the surface. Film music is about what you should feel. My job is to make you feel something. Sometimes I'm manipulating your emotions. And I can also change your heart rate. I can do things like that. There are weird things that happen in the cinema, for instance, where people's heart rates synchronize.
Wow.
There are
Wow.
things, you know, and that's something that music can do over almost anything else. We can actually change people's physiology, don't in a way.
So what are you looking forward to working on apart from the Avatar stuff? What
I've
else
got a
is
couple of
what else do you
films
have?
I'm looking at doing this year. I was going to take a break, but I'm actually feeling pretty fresh now. It wasn't as bad. Avatar 2 was pretty tough because we were in the COVID. It was lockdowns. It was really.
Hard to get anything done when you can't actually see anybody.
No, I was. It was pretty tough for a while, and it was an intense process. We got through it, and I was very proud with how we got through it. This one has been a little easier, and for that and many other reasons. And I've got a couple of films, one of which I think will be very interesting to you both, and I can't tell you what it is.
Right, because yes,
Yeah, because
non-disclosure agreements, they would hang you
exactly.
up.
But there's a film later this year that I'm so excited about doing. I think it'll be great. And it very much is something that falls into the genres that we're talking about.
And your publicist Rebecca should hopefully remind us of this when the time comes so that we can
Yeah,
have you back.
well, I'd be very, very, very happy to come back. It's always a joy to talk about this, and since I have a couple of synth fiends as well here to talk to, that's not a terrible thing.
Oh, yeah, I can sit and geek out about early Moog for days. Well,
Yeah.
and I was there in the let's see, 1980, I
Noob.
want to say 1984,
Yeah.
85, 86, when Devo was rehearsing in the at a place called Modern Props. They
Oh.
rented studio space,
The earth where they
so I
going
got
with
to.
modern props? Did they borrow props from you or something?
No, they knew each other from Kent State.
Oh.
John Zabrecki and Mark Mothersbaugh went to Kent State together, and Devo was leasing space from them, and they had their Jupiter 8 set up. And the Fairlight was the big thing they had,
Yeah.
which, looking back on it, you know, the Fairlight in those days, that was an 8-bit synthesizer.
Oh, it was an 8-bit sampler. No, I that when I was working first at the first thing I worked on was a PPG Wave and Wave 2. And that was a parallel German thing. But the when I went to Trevor Horner working at his studio, I was the Synclavier guy, but he had a Fairlight as well. And so we were compared. The Synclavier sounded way better, but the Fairlight had Page R. The Fairlight could do rhythm programming, and whereas I had to play everything from beginning to end, which is sort of defined my style. I don't generally don't loop. I don't cut and paste. I will play a hi-hat, for instance, from the beginning to the end, or I will play drums manually from the beginning to end rather than cutting and pasting stuff. And that was because the first machine I ever worked on didn't have cut and paste when I first started working on it.
Well,
But things like the Jupiter, I remember seeing Devo, and Kraftwerk, in that they seeing them early on. And my great hero was Issei Otomita,
Oh yes. Oh yes.
who for if you asked me like
From those days, he was everybody's hero. He
the
was amazing.
people do not understand that we anybody who does synths now who thinks that they are somehow the gods of synth, they are but tiny children in comparison to Tomita. You look at his work on the work that he was doing, it dwarfed everything that anybody else was doing. He could make these things just, it was astonishing how he was making these things were speak and sing and play. And he would do these unbelievably complex renditions of classical music, but entirely using the early Moog modulars and also some of the Buchlers and stuff like this, and the individual arps
With their giant hand-wired patch bays to get the sounds.
oh, absolutely, and
The
the
ARP
G.
2600 looked like the dashboard of a space shuttle.
Well, that was a baby compared to the 2000 and the. And what he was using, he was, I think, still to this day, there's been no one who even came close to the ability of him in terms of actually the staggering ability that he had in terms of synthesizing. People listen to these albums when when Snowflakes and Dancing first came out, Snowflakes Are Dancing first came out. You just sat there. I always remember I was like a kid. This thing appeared, and it's like, you could do that. I couldn't believe the sound it made. Wendy Carlos, who you sit there going, this is amazing. And then you listen to this, and this was like another level. It's like somebody had come in from another planet and said, by the way, hold my beer. This is what you can read.
Yeah,
Astonishing.
that's very apt. I had forgotten about Tomita and how big of an impact that Tomita had when I first heard his music.
Oh,
It was
it, for me,
just it was like going to church. It was really, really something.
absolutely, because there was there were the people like Rick Wakeman and the guys who were playing all the synths on stage, and they would have 500 keyboards around that. But it was all still the same sorts of sounds in general. And then there was this man, this Japanese guy who somehow was making noises that I'd never heard before. And then you'd hear the Yellow Magic Orchestra with the work that they were doing. Again, there was some astonishing work that they were doing with Behind the Mask and some of those albums there. I'm sorry, I'm geeking out like crazy at this point. And then there was the Europeans, that I'd look at some of the work that the people like Can were doing and Tangerine Dream, but they were.
Oh, yes.
But they still, for me, weren't anywhere close to what Tomita did. But it
Well,
was
and
some.
I think the reason there was that groups like Tangerine Dream, they were all about like traveling in this narrow lane
Yeah, it's
and
very
without
true.
really deviating from that they found their sound and they stuck with it and they never traveled outside that lane once they found it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And then you would see people. I'm a huge fan of Peter Gabriel, and I think that as I look at some of the work that he's always attempted to find, to take a path that has been less traveled, I think.
Yeah, but Tomita walked so Peter Gabriel could run.
Well, Peter Gabriel, famous for his drumming and that incredible smash hit, smashing drum strike that resulted from a studio accident, a feedback loop from a microphone that was it was a clipping that fed back into the recording. It took them a while to figure out where it was coming from, and then they figured out how to do it on purpose.
And I think that's the thing is that when we were younger, When I was making records when I was younger, there was record people record sales was would so much higher than they are now. The finances of making records meant that people could experiment and they could try out making new things. They could try seeing where they could go. And these days, that's harder for young artists to do. I think it's which is a shame.
Well, it's harder for young artists to make a living doing it at all
Absolutely.
because the distribution systems have all collapsed.
Entirely. I mean, I look at my son, who is a phenomenal musician. He's infinitely better than me, and he's, I look at the world in which he's working and think it's so difficult for people to. The breaking through period is all about social media these days, instead of being
Yes.
about
Well,
and that.
it's very much like that for science fiction writers as well. It's
Oh yeah.
if you don't have, I mean, 20 years ago, or even 15 years ago, you could go get an agent, get yourself a publisher, publish, and on the basis of the quality of the work alone, you could develop a reputation. And that doesn't work anymore. It's all
Yeah.
social media.
I mean, you can publish without
You can publish
having
with.
to convince anybody that it should be a book, but getting people to read it, that's another matter.
And so there are all these independently published authors and self-published authors, me included. And it's a jungle. It's
Yeah.
the amount of leverage that each individual artist has is minuscule compared to the clout that the record labels used to
I mean,
have.
I think it's different also. I mean, I've still got a bookshelf full of the iRobot and all of the Asimov books of which I grew up with, and Heinleins and those things like that. Those were the things that I had when I was a kid. And there were magazines of science fiction, short stories and stuff like
Well,
that.
they're still here, but they're published online.
Yeah,
Yeah.
well, and they're very limited distribution now, but you had your analog science fiction,
Yeah.
galaxy science fiction, worlds of If.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're online. They're, some of those passed off, and but somebody else is reviving the titles. The magazine of fantasy and science fiction has been going the whole time, and that's online. And we've talked to their editor. She's amazing. No,
Yeah.
amazing was another magazine. Anyway.
But getting back to the point, the world has changed very much since then, and it's
You know what? When we're squatting in caves and traveling to bring the news to our fellow cave dwellers, well, those of us with acoustic instruments will be in good shape.
I mean, I'm very pleased that I'm one of the great things about working for Jim Cameron is he cares about cinema and cinema being something of being a shared experience. And I think that there's something about when I look at I play with virtual reality, a lot of stuff like that, just because I'm obsessed with immersive audio and what you can do with immersive audio. And I've got all of the
He's off to fetch
I have
something.
all of the these and
Oh,
stuff.
wow, you've got the Apple one.
I've got MetaQuest and I've got Vision Pro. I've got
Yeah, I've got a MetaQuest 3.
And I'm trying to save up for the Apple version because I'm the Apple
No,
head in the
I
house.
can tell you that the MetaQuest 3 I think is superb. It really is. I mean, I think the Apple is amazing. It's just that I have difficulty understanding what, except for someone who's a complete immersive nerd like me, and it's my job, why would you spend 3,500? And that's the thing is when
Right,
you actually
right.
do the comparison, I can watch a movie on the MetaQuest. It's an astonishing thing to do. To go through the Horizon world, I think there's some amazing stuff you can do in terms of that. I think it has. As a first, if we imagine that we are knocking on the door of where this is going to head, I think there's some amazing places that we can go.
Do you create environments yourself, or do
Oh
you
yeah, I've been involved in immersive audio for over a decade, And I've done large-scale things that are on the top of buildings with 240 loudspeakers in a Taurus.
Wow.
I've done immersive worlds that are just virtual, where you walk around inside the virtual world. And I believe that that is an incredibly exciting thing, because music has always been something that in the past we've always it's always been over there. And what I mean by that is, if you take anything back to the past 1,000 years, music has been something that you digest, because they're on stage, they're over there. There's the proscenium arch, and people perform on a stage in front of you. And that's not that different to stereo speakers being over there, or the TV being over there, and you watch something over there. Whereas this, a 3D environment, is the first time when I can mix things, where I can really have stuff. I can walk around. I did a project with Pink Floyd called, it was they would did an exhibition called Their Mortal Remains. And part of that, they gave me the masters to a load of their great recordings, and we mixed them in a pure three-dimensional space with picture all around you. And you could walk towards Roger Waters and you could hear more bass, or you could walk towards Rick Wright, or you could walk towards Dave Gilmour, or you could hear, you could go and hear Nick Mason and Clear. And you would always, the mix would never fold down, but you could walk towards Roger's bass, and then you'd hear his bass more clearly, but the mix would still be there. But having this thing where, instead of them just being one space over there, suddenly there was all of these walls, because we treated the mix as if any place was home. You didn't have to be, by putting the drums in the middle, we effectively anchored the mix so that you could be three-dimensionally anywhere you wanted, and people could walk around in that space. And it was a phenomenal thing to actually hear music like that, because it made it much more of a connection between you. If you think about the headphones, have that massive advantage of being like piped into your brain. But now that we've got some ability to actually now give you spatial information three-dimensionally in headphones, you have this ability to really hear so much more. I did a mix of Shaft, the Isaac Hayes Shaft, the wah-wah-wah-wah-wah, with the wah-wah guitar, and you could spin the wah-wah guitar around you like that and do things like that. And it sounds stupid, but it actually made the music feel like it was part of a performance, and the performance was there. Just the way that, for instance, Pink Floyd had quadraphonic sound on their concerts when they early, I think that that idea of music being a something that you can be inside is really exciting. And so some of the things that the Meta Horizons are doing, and what can be done with some of the things that the Vision Pro is able to do, I think is astonishingly great. I just think that, unfortunately, the weight and the cumbersomeness of what we have at the moment is undoubtedly going to get less. And I don't know that I want to spend days with these things on. I've tried mixing sound with using these as my monitors. And there's a point when it gets a little
Yeah,
strange.
after about 2 hours, you start to get this pinch in your forehead, right between your eyes.
But
And you
that's
want
gonna change. That's why I haven't really hurried down to buy anything new, because I'm just
I think the
waiting to
meta.
see what the, where really wearable things are gonna end up.
It's also, I think, that the destination is yet to be defined in terms of this, that we're at the moment, we've opened this door, but we haven't quite worked out what to do about how we walk around in this space. How do we feel about it? How do you make it so that it isn't feel so isolating for everybody? If there's the pair of you there, how do you, the two of you, inhabit a space together and actually use it to go around there? I've looked at some of the inverted commas National Geographic stuff that you see, And I found it like amazing. There was this one of Pamplona being, walking around with the bull, running of the bulls in Pamplona, something I'd never do and not something I'm not interested, but it was just to discover those spaces or to go on the top of a mountain, look out. And so some of those bits where you experience space in a different way, I found astonishingly immersive. And I think that there's so much that one can do in those worlds. I'm very excited by what those can provide us.
Well, it's very similar to the way Disney designs their soundscapes for their real
Right.
life
Yeah.
visitor environments. Every you go into a space and they've cr excuse me. And they've created the audio portion of an entire three-dimensional world in physical space. And it's there are few things like it, I think, and virtual reality parallels with that.
I mean, as
But I think.
somebody who's done that with Pandora World Avatar down in Florida, I've still we spent a
There
lot
you
of
go.
time.
There it is.
There it is. Yeah.
Yeah, so I built those. That's a 5 hours of music, and you're exactly what you're saying. We spent forever building those immersive spaces. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we are talking to Simon Franglin, one of the most prominent composers in the motion picture theatrical workspace today. And you have just finished Avatar Fire and Ash. And I was going to say earlier on, you mentioned that you would be doing
Something did.
Avatar 4 and 5 if 1, 2, and 3 did well. One and two,
Three just broke some records,
yeah,
so
three just broke some.
I don't think that's going
Yeah,
to be a problem.
one, two, and three each did $1 billion each.
So what? One is the biggest film of all time. So one is 2.9 billion.
But each of them broke
But
one
Avatar 3 has
one.
been out for what, a week?
Yeah,
And it's broken up.
we're at
It's already hit.
1.2 billion. I think we're hoping we'll head up into the higher ones for this one, but
Yeah.
that may change. We'll see.
I think it's
But
going to go more than that
yeah,
because the films,
they keep raising ticket prices for one thing.
well, yeah, that's part of it. And the other part of it is the more films you have, the greater body of work it is, and the more legs each of the films has in
Yeah.
terms of digital distribution.
Oh yeah,
I
that no, we have, as you noticed when you watch Where Water on Disney Plus or whatever it was. I know that when we released Where Water, it was the number one film on Disney Plus for that for the
Yeah,
year.
it's yeah. We when we loaded up
Yeah,
Disney
and we
Plus to watch
helped.
it, yeah, and we helped. But when we loaded it up to watch it, it was like the first few films they show you, it's like it's number two.
No,
And the
I'm
first one I think was Stranger Things, was it?
not on
No,
Disney.
not on Disney.
Not
It was
Disney,
something
that's a
else. It's
Netflix.
Netflix, sweetie. That's
Yeah.
Netflix. It was something else, but
But still, for a 3-year-old film, it's pretty
I
respectable.
think yeah, I think that the
I think people were watching, film number two to get ready for film number three too, as well.
yeah, I think that's fair. And I think it's so different to anything else. It really is a unique experience, that having spent so many years working on these with Jim, the care that goes into every frame that you see, and the time and effort, I think we're probably the best value for money in the cinema that you can possibly get.
I agree with you. I was expecting some immersion, but I was not expecting that.
Yeah.
That was really, really something, a real experience.
Yeah.
That's okay. We're gonna have we're probably maybe we should wait till the next heat wave, so if it's like 100 degrees out, fire and ash will feel really realistic.
Yeah, no, I can I think that there's also it's a reason to go to the cinema rather than just watch,
Yes,
that's the thing.
yes.
And I think that he's trying to remind people that the cinema is important.
I agree.
Yeah.
I very much agree. Simon Franklin, thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of The Event Horizon here on sci-fi.radio. It has been a pleasure and a half.
An honor and a privilege.
It's been my honor. Thank you very much for having me, and what a great name for a show as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, well, it's I've enjoyed every second.
You have been listening to episode 290 of Sci-Fi Radio's production of The Event Horizon for January 10th, 2026. Our guest this evening has been Simon Franklin, the world-class composer responsible for the motion picture score for Avatar, Fire, and Ash. The show will air again tomorrow, January 11th, at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, and again on the upcoming Thursday and Saturday mornings at 4 a.m. Pacific, 7 a.m. Eastern. After all the airtimes have passed, you will find this episode and others on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbay FM, Pandora, Stitcher, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and on our own website at sci-fi.radio. If you've enjoyed the programming you have just heard, please consider visiting patreon.com/sci-fi radio and becoming a patron of the station. We are listener-supported sci-fi and fantasy fandom radio, and your contributions go to paying our DJs, our production team, our writers for our geek news website, our business operation fees, our music licensing, and for the equipment we must procure and maintain in order to stay on the air. We have been broadcasting on this basis continuously since 2009, and we are thankful for the support of listeners just like you. That URL again, patreon.com/sci-fi radio. This episode is copyright 2026 by Krypton Media Group, Incorporated. The Event Horizon on sci-fi.radio. It's sci-fi for your Wi-Fi.
sci-fi.radio.